CNR Online.
The music industry began looking frantically for a sound that would appeal to the young record buyers. And it occurred not in Los Angeles, New York, nor in London, but in the north of England, the north of England, the north of England.
The world's most famous, influential and notorious nightclub opened its doors on May the 21st, 1982. It was a product of one industrial city in the north of England that, against all the odds, changed the face of nightclubbing the world over.
We had a wonderful time, it was great. And all these cultures, things come and go. There's no point trying to keep them going. It's like it had its time. As someone who doesn't like the fact that the circus isn't there anymore as an historic site, I should probably have defended the Hacienda more, but at the time it seemed cooler to say, nah, pull it down. It was originally a steel stockholding building,
right,
whose only use after that was either as a yacht showroom, which it was, or as a place for New Order and Factory Records to throw all their money down a large hole.
The legendary club would influence a generation. Its stark industrial design pushed aside the established going-out experience. It was unlike anything partygoers had seen before. It was truly one of a kind.
Grow up, children, don't you suffer at the hands of one another. If you like a sleepy.
What Factory Records brought to Manchester wasn't so much a home for me or anybody to go to. It was just the fact that they put a nightclub in the city, like a focal point, which is the difference between London. London had 50 nightclubs, Manchester had one.
Financed by Factory Records label boss Tony Wilson and New Order, its 16-year reign would end in financial ruin.
So they got investigated for PAYE and National Insurance irregularities. We went through the whole of the Hacienda, and then they moved on to Factory, and then they moved on to New Order and Joy Division, and we all got investigated and we all got absolutely stuffed by the taxman, culminating in the biggest fine for any group in England ever. Yes, we got fined something like £900,000.
The club had a constant battle against the drugs, the gangs and the authorities.
There was a constant battle with the chief constable, wasn't it? He was trying to shut everything down, so there was a constant battle with him. I mean, I remember on a New Year's Eve going to the house, and then afterwards there was always, you know, where's the party? And there was always a rumour where it was, and there was a party in Ancoats, lovely place, in this old warehouse. I remember going to the party, and there was, it was only like a couple of hundred people or something there, and there was a police cordon around the building with riot shields and a police helicopter flying overhead with searchlights. It's just New Year's Eve, for God's sake, you know.
It introduced a generation to techno, acid house, and its own musical byproduct, Manchester.
People like the Inspirals and the Mondays and the Roses, and we were doing our thing, you know, we were just doing what we did, and then there was suddenly this new sort of music coming in through the Hacienda, mainly, you know, from Detroit or Chicago, wherever it was. We were sort of observing that revolution and not realising that we were starting to embrace it.
Following a drug-related death and outbreaks of heavy violence and shootings, the club finally closed its doors in 1997. I'm Pete Mitchell, and I was a member and regular throughout its 16-year existence. What happened within its four walls was truly remarkable. Its clientele ranged from happy students to serious drug gang members, but we all shared the same joyful, exhilarating experience.
Changed my life, actually, and I think the thing is that, you know, for absent friends, I think it deserves to be noted for Ian Curtis. Without him, it wouldn't have existed. Martin Hannett, without him, it wouldn't have existed. Tony Wilson, Rob Gretton.
Victory Records label and club was set up by Granada TV presenter and journalist Tony Wilson. He was born in Salford and graduated with a degree in English from Jesus College, Oxford. After his graduation, he became a trainee news reporter with ITN, eventually securing a post at Granada TV Manchester in 1973. Radio, live transmission. He presented a regular music and arts segment on Granada Reports called What's On and his own weekly show, So It Goes. He gave the Sex Pistols their first TV break. The whole saga began with an inheritance left to him by his mother in the late 70s. The cash turned his dream into reality. Tony was a staunch supporter of the local music scene and wanted to start up his own independent record label. He would finance and start up Factory, signing Joy Division New Order, Happy Mondays and Juriti Column. The Hacienda Nightclub would soon follow. Here is the late Tony Wilson speaking to me in 2004.
My mum died in 75, and the inheritance I got was £12,000, which in 75 was quite a bit of money. It was in unit trusts and shares in the Manchester Ship Canal. God bless you, mum. So then I used £5,000 of it to do the first record, and then in those days you put records out independently to get your band signed. So we got the first of our bands signed, which was Orchestral Maneuvers, and flogged them off to Virgin. Joy Division were about to go to Warner Brothers, did a nice job for them, and then Mr. Gretton went, maybe we should do the first album with you before we leave. And I said, are you sure? I did not express immediate enthusiasm for what was indeed the foundation of the independent record label system in Britain.
Tony was up and running. Along with manager Rob Gretton, they began to wade through his inheritance, recording the seminal debut album by Joy Division, and No Pleasures, on the brand new Factory Records label. She's lost control, and she's clinging to the nearest passerby. She's lost control.
I said, how much do they cost? Well, Martin says it'll cost £5,000, who was the producer. It actually cost £10,000. So with the £12,000 my mother left me, we managed to produce Unknown Pleasures. Mm. And the way independent record labels work is if you have a even halfway successful album, the profit margin, you're in business. And Unknown Pleasures put us in business.
After the initial burst of punk in the late 70s, nightlife in Manchester offered very little choice, apart from the Main Street discotheque and kebab shop. For those on the fringes, there was little or no alternative for the post-punk crowd. Here is Peter Hook of Joy Division New Order.
No, I mean, the whole point for post-punk in Manchester was that there were no clubs that catered for you. It was all the Ritz, Rosses, Tiffany's, and you had to dress accordingly. You know, white shirt, jacket, and a pair of trousers and shoes. You know, you couldn't get in otherwise, so us lot were basically stuck with the ranch on a Thursday night and gigs.
Joy Division and New Order manager Rob Gretton wanted an urban space to fulfil his dream of having a live stage, music venue and nightclub based on the New York clubs he had visited with his band New Order.
I knew that in Manchester we didn't have anywhere to go. So Rob and Tony were absolutely right. You didn't have anywhere to go. And Rob had been inspired by the tour that we did in America, by the clubs in America that were all very dark and dingy, very warehousey, very of the moment. You know, like they'd just been thrown up, like you'd just kick the door open and put a club in. You know, it was very DIY ethic. He'd been really impressed by that because we'd been to loads of them in New York.
Tier 3, Hurrahs, Danceteria, you know, they were all like that. They're all very mood dark, very incestuous. It felt, wow, you know, it felt quite clubby.
Really good. So that was what was his inspiration. The opening of the club, funnily enough, we didn't have a lot to do with. We really were so engrossed in doing New Order that Rob came to us with the idea when we'd come back from America as New Order, Three Peaks, and said we should open our own club.
Rob Gretton found premises in the centre of the city. A former warehouse at 11 to 13 Whitwood Street West on the south side of the Rochdale Canal was a vacuous, empty building that had previously been a yacht builder's shop and a Bollywood cinema in the 1970s. It was perfect. Work began and suitable designers and architects were hired. Peter Hook.
He asked Savile to design it. He told us it had cost something like 40 grand between us, which we thought, well, you know, we didn't have any money and we were only on 13 quid a week or something. So it just seemed, you know, yeah, whatever, you know, another one of his crackpot ideas, really. So he carried on and he came back to us a couple of times and said, oh, it's going to be a little bit more than 40,000. I think in the end he told us it was going to be 155,000 and it was half funded by Factory and half funded by us, which was quite interesting because New Order didn't have any money then because we didn't have any records out. So it was funded by Joy Division, actually. But I think that's one of the cute anomalies of accounting. Yes, with Factory and Rob Gretton, God rest his soul. Yeah, but anyway, it appeared, the Hacienda, pretty much without our input, to be honest. We were busy recording, writing, and we'd also had our gear stolen in America, so we had nothing. So we had to build all up again. Not only had we lost the lead singer, we'd managed to lose all the equipment as well. So we had our hands full, shall we say, and occasionally Robert would go, oh, the club's coming along, you know, club's coming along, you should go down, and stuff like that. But we weren't really interested, to be honest. I think I went down once, and I just walked in this big warehouse that used to be a yacht showroom on Whitworth Street. You just didn't seem that interesting, to be honest. I think what happened then was Peter Savile got Ben Kelly involved. Ben Kelly had never designed a club before, but it came on quite quickly. We did hear about problems, but, you know, the problems like the balcony being in the wrong place, balcony being of the wrong design. And we laughed, you know, we thought it was funny. You know, so it's a weird sense of humour. And then all of a sudden, it was built, and it actually cost something like 454,000 or something. So by the time it was finished, it was about 500,000 we'd spent on it. Absolute fortune, yeah. And they'd also made a huge mistake in signing a 25-year lease, which they couldn't get out of when it started to go wrong.
It was named the Hacienda, inspired by writer Ivan Chechniklov, and Fact 51 was its official designation in the Factory catalogue. New Order and Tony Wilson were directors. Its stores eventually opened on May the 21st, 1982. The first act to play the Hacienda was Manchester's favourite controversial stand-up, Bernard Manning, followed by A Certain Ratio. Tony Wilson had booked him to compare the launch, thinking it would be ironic.
Is that your girlfriend here? Wife? You've got the right bollock there, didn't you? Well, everybody's got a cross to bear, son, and that's yours. I bet she looks all right after about 25 pints, though, eh?
After finishing his act, Manning reportedly told Tony Wilson and Rob Gretton to stick to your day job, lads. You're not cut out for the clubs. Hey, that's showbiz.
The opening night was quite low-key, quite chaotic. Being allowed backstage and being in the club was pretty wild because it did look fantastic. And it was full as well, the opening night. I mean, yeah, Rob Gretton always found it very easy to give away booze. It was all free, so it was packed. Yeah, A Certain Ratio played. There was a jamming session on stage, and we were all there. Yeah, you know, it was a bit surreal and a bit unreal. Shaka, so I don't believe it.
The initial success of the opening night was short-lived as the club's attendances began to dwindle. Opening seven nights a week was problematic and expensive. Peter Hook.
Some of them were busy and some of them weren't. It fell out of favour, actually. After the party, when it opened, it fell out of favour. People didn't like it, and I think there was a kind of factory backlash. And it was open Saturday lunchtime and Sunday lunchtime as a private members club. But the thing was, is that they sort of shot themselves in the foot with the design, because the design was so big and spectacular that when you went in with just a couple of mates, you felt like you were in Victoria Station. So it wasn't really it didn't have a vibe when there wasn't many people in. It suffered from that.
Director Tony Wilson almost immediately began to realise that his vision of a successful vast entertainment space in the city centre was flawed.
Over this 20-year cycle, 76-92, 16 years, there are lovely, lovely historical things. For example, that, you know, we built the club because we'd seen these fancy clubs in New York. This is 81, 82. We've seen these fancy clubs in New York. And someone said, you know, with 2 weeks opening, who have you built this for? And we go, the kids. And they go, have you seen the kids? They're wearing long grey raincoats. You've built a fancy New York disco. And we go, oh yeah, sorry. And which was one of the reasons it was empty, apart from the eight of us who built it for ourselves for many years.
Likes to tell you just what I want to. I'm not the kind that needs to tell you just what you want to.
The one thing that can be said about Tony Wilson was that he was loyal. The problems facing New Order after the tragic death of friend and singer Ian Curtis died seemed insurmountable.
The thing is that you have to bear in mind that Tony Wilson's attitude to groups was quite unique. But when he did like a group, he stuck with them. You know, I mean, it's like it would have been quite easy for him to get rid of New Order after Ian had died and said, oh no, you know, I want a proper group. Not one with a, you know, lead singer pretending to be a lead singer. I want a proper. But he wasn't like that. He was very loyal. He was very, very trustworthy with you. You know, once you'd got him.
No one at the time could have possibly predicted how much keeping the Hacienda afloat would cost. New Order were focused on making the best records that they could, but the distraction of the club was beginning to dawn on the band, and before long, the enormity of financing the club would hit home.
Well, it was hard work at the time, you know, and it took us a long time to establish ourselves. But I think the thing was then, it's, you know, if you look at it on a timeline from Movement to Power, Corruption and Lies, it was actually pretty quick. So we were working very hard to establish New Order. And we used to play at the club, basically, when the club had run out of money, so that the club could get some money. Yeah, we used to sell it. Yeah, I mean, we just got to that point, really. I suppose it would be 83, 84, where you were big enough to sell out the Hacienda.
You're listening to CNR Online. Advertise your business on this station for less than €7 a day. That's €7 to advertise your business here on CNR. For full details, check out the website, all the WCNR-online.com. CNR Online.
Story of the Hacienda, the world's most famous nightclub. During its first 12 months, the only clientele frequenting the establishment was that of the factory staff and their hangers-on. Here's Peter Hook.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it was became a free club for us to go to. So I didn't have a lot to do with it. I didn't have anything to do with the planning. The only time that we started to get involved was when it all went wrong. And we started hearing the horror stories. I mean, we were very busy, you see. We were always gigging. Yeah, I used to work there because I didn't have any money. I used to work at the Hacienda and they used to pay me £10 a night for loading the equipment in, doing backstage security. I was a roadie in my own club, yeah.
Could I recognize all these things you must have left behind?
Well, I didn't know, you see. I mean, the ramifications of owning it and the cost just never came home to you. You didn't understand it. And really, I had no wish to understand it. You know, the greatest thing I thought was that not only could I get in free and get free drinks, but I also got paid for working there. So to me, it was fantastic, you know, and I never really understood what had happened. Factory had actually 7 accountants and 1 A&R man, but they were all absolutely, completely disorganised. I mean, Tony and Rob were wonderful at getting ideas, they were wonderful at being unique, really off the wall, and being very exciting with what they were doing with music and clubs, but they didn't care about the business side of it. So everybody took advantage of them, and just basically they were ripped off right from the moment they got the first checkout to start the whole venture. You know, it was like they were like lambs to the slaughter.
During its first year, Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen, Thompson Twins, Simple Minds and Grandmaster Flash all appeared. The Hacienda booking policy was left as centre.
You know, you have to remember that these groups that Rob and Mike Pickering and Howard Jones were championing were new bands. You know, they were very radical, cutting-edge groups. They were also championing Detroit and Chicago House from 1983 onwards, and nobody knew what it was and nobody cared. I've got a collection of flyers, and there's one flyer from 1983, late 83, that's got Marshall Jefferson on. All the DJs, rather, that would look current now, they're all still there, aren't they? You know, they were, and Mike Pickering and Rob Gretton were championing them then.
As electronic music began to make ground in the early 80s, New Order, influenced by the likes of Can and Kraftwerk, began to experiment. Tony Wilson noticed the musical shift.
I always say the one thing that marks Manchester out from the rest of the musical world, from Bristol, Seattle, Glasgow, San Francisco, is that we were, not any longer, tragically, but we were the one city that does not separate dance and rock. Could be into both without feeling bad about it. And that's why probably Joy Division, New Order are archetypal. And it's not just Joy Division into New Order. I mean, Joy Division, there is a track called Isolation, where you're beginning to feel that a bit of a disco beat there. And they come out of that. And I think their invention of electronics and the way they work with electronics in particular, I tell you what, I'm give you the most important electro track in my opinion, because it's where it all starts, with the most remarkable song produced by Martin Hannett, to give him his due, Everything's Gone Green.
As the club began to garner worldwide acclaim, its reputation and music was picked up by DJs in Detroit and Chicago. The likes of Derek May, Kevin Sonderson and Juan Atkins absorbed the music emanating from Manchester in the north of England. Tony Wilson.
By strange chance, it becomes the collision point for Ibizan dance drug culture and this obscure American stuff called house music. So no, it was just, that was wonderful. And one of the things I particularly love is that if you read interviews with Marshall Jefferson and Derek May and all the other guys, the DJs creating this music in 84, 85, 86 in Chicago, Detroit, they'd spend the early 80s bored with American black music, driving around their cars around the derelict streets of Detroit, listening to the early synthesizer bands from England, in particular Depeche Mode and New Order. Weird. So I mean, I just love the way history works like that.
As New Order were hitting a creative high, the financial problems facing the club were escalating.
Well, I mean, the goings-on were, they were actually quite boring, to be honest with you. Do you know what I mean? It's quite boring to go on with it. And what Rob always used to say That's the price for changing the world, you know. And you were going, well, does he seem a little high? Oh, God. You know, and his other ethos was always, you've got to put back something into the place that made you. And you were going, well, do we have to put everything back? Can't we just keep a little bit?
How does it feel to treat me like you do?
It was quite an odd thing, and I don't want to be too negative about it, because the thing is that the Hacienda was very, very important to Manchester as a gig. Every decent band in England, in the world, played at the Hacienda, and it was a very, very important venue. But unfortunately, it was run by idiots, and those idiots were our friends. And that is one thing I learned, is that your friends are your friends not because they're great at business, they're great at having a pint with, and not at business. And so basically, we weren't involved with it from a business point of view until it really went wrong. By that stage, there was too many debts and there was too many mistakes, and it was impossible to get round it. And what happened was, it's all in my book, if any of you want to read it. Pain and Misery, Other People's is funny. The thing is that what happened was that the PAYE, as it was then, suspected we were paying some of the umpers cash. Right, so they phoned up and said, we're coming down for an inspection, we want to inspect your books. Now, most businesses in those days, and I must stress that they don't do that these days, they kept a little book for cash and a little book for legal, you know, for the tax man. Two sets of books, yeah. One was what you paid cash so you could balance what was coming into you, and the other one was what you paid, you know, that was legal, that was taxed. So anyway, the girl on the door, somebody said to her, this guy's coming down, make sure you give him these books. And when he came down, she gave him the wrong books. So that was it then. We were absolutely stuffed. She gave him the cash in hand book. So he had his bang to rights. They got investigated for PAYE and National Insurance irregularities. They went through the whole of the Hacienda. And then they moved on to Factory. And then they moved on to New Order and Joy Division. And we all got investigated. And we all got absolutely stuffed by the taxman. Culminating in the biggest fine for any group in England ever. Yes, we got fined something like £900,000 in 1986. So it was a pretty gloomy period. We managed to get back from it, but it meant that you were still on 13 quid a week, even though Blue Monday had, you know, sold millions and millions of copies. But I mean, you know, the thing is that what I've learned is that to be truly unique in this world, you have to take a few chances and you have to make a few mistakes. And I think that's what Rob and Tony realised, that basically it was just money. But the fame and the way that the Hacienda changed the world of music and clubbing, and England in particular, and Manchester especially, it was worth every penny.
By 1986, the house scene was becoming established. There was a shift away from live bands to DJs as house and techno took over the club. Numbers swelled at the Hacienda and the second summer of love was dawning. The recreational drug ecstasy would sweep through the dance clubs and illegal raves across Great Britain. Hacienda DJ, Dave Haslam.
Early 1988, when the Hacienda was a busy club by then, but the arrival of ecstasy did take it onto a whole other level, and it meant that there was a lot more, the chemistry, you know, which is kind of quite an odd word to use, but the chemistry in the club changed, and it got a lot more intense and a lot more trippy and a lot more druggy, and the audience changed and the fashions changed. I think ecstasy made a big difference, because ecstasy opens people's minds, you know, and you know, there's always people that look back and go, you know, what, the ecstasy helped white kids to learn how to dance, which is a little bit patronising, because, you know, if you look at Northern Soul, white kids always were able to dance. But certainly Ecstasy seemed to make people more willing and more happy to just accept music. Obviously, it's not an aggressive drug, but that meant that always helped break things down. You know, the Mondays, again, you know, allegedly had pioneered the use of ecstasy in the Hacienda Club, shall we say. So there was kind of, you know, I think the music did definitely make a difference.
The summer of love began to spread, taking in Ibiza. And for one summer, it seemed like the whole of Manchester decamped to the island. Peter Hook.
It was a very interesting period, yeah. Thing was, is that it got a lightness. Before, in the Hacienda, before Acid House, it was all about gigs. It was only the gigs that had a big attendance and a vibe. The club nights were very, very, very quiet. So the gig nights were okay, but everything else was lonely. All of a sudden, once Ecstasy hit, and you know, it started to do the same in London with Shume and you know, Danny Rampling's clubs, it went berserk. It did seem like it was overnight, but I mean, the thing is that we were in Ibiza that summer trying to do some recording. As Tony Wilson said, this is the most expensive holiday you've ever had. The Happy Mondays came over to Ibiza because we told them how wild the island was. With Ecstasy, yeah, it was proper hedonism. It was wild. It was crazy. They came over to sample it. And basically, that's when they took it back to Manchester. And by the time we got back to Manchester, you know, a month or 2 months later, everything had gone completely bonkers.
Not only did the Hacienda introduce acid house and techno to the UK, it produced its own musical byproduct, Madchester. And for factory boss and Hacienda director Tony Wilson, the one group that sums up the whole scene, the Happy Mondays.
This is the group that made the Hacienda, I suppose, or made it all happen, not only because they were the main importer of drugs, not only because they were, in the words of the Daily Telegraph, the people who adapted the rhythms. I mean, rock and roll, this glorious thing that we're here for, is about Africa meeting Europe. It's about black meeting white. And one of the most sublime examples is when the rhythms of house music out of Chicago and Detroit, which in a way, house music came out of people like Marshall Jefferson getting bored with American soul music in the early 80s and listening to Depeche Mode and New Order. And then suddenly this house music rhythms comes along, and it's the Happy Mondays who adapt those rhythms before anybody else to British punk and British pop, and they create the most wonderful music. And to be honest, I mean, I'm a big Stone Roses fan, the greatest rock group of the 80s, but we now remember the Roses for things like Fool's Gold. Things like Fool's Gold don't happen until the Mondays change music.
Manchester originated in the alcoves of the Hacienda. You know, Ian Brown, In Spirals, Roses, everyone. You know, right to Mock Turtles, you name them. Every band that came out of Manchester was in the Hacienda. And I suppose it was that wonderful thing about the Hacienda, it had no VIP section. So everybody had to mix. And it gave it a wonderful aura. You know, everybody enjoyed the way that it was, we were all in it together. I suppose one of the first bones of contention in New Order was Bernard and Stephen grasping electronics and me trying to pull it back to rock. And it was only because I wanted to rock and they wanted to be electronic, and that's how you got the hybrid to please us all of rock with dance that became the template for music from then on, really.
Clint Boone.
People like the Spirals and the Mondays and the Roses, and we were doing our thing, you know, we were just doing what we did, and then there was suddenly this new sort of music coming in through the Hacienda, mainly, you know, from Detroit or Chicago, wherever it was. We were sort of observing that revolution and not realising that we were starting to embrace it. And I think a lot of the other indie bands, you know, in the same way, the Mondays at the same time were down at the Hacienda, they were enjoying this new music that was coming in, and, you know, they started bringing that into their sound, dabbling with drum machines and sequences. They were dabbling with these machines in 87, 88. People were just suddenly embracing this new sound and allowing it to be absorbed into what we were doing instead of resenting it and kicking against it.
Noel Gallagher. What Factory Records brought to Manchester wasn't so much a home for me or anybody to go to. It was just the fact that they put a nightclub in the city, like a focal point, which is the difference between London. London had 50 nightclubs, Manchester had one, and that's why that acid house thing, it was all centred around there. And they had Tony Wilson, who was on telly, which made it a bit more valid, do you know what I mean? And he brought... Factory gave it that, yes, these bands can be on top of the pops, but they can still come from here. Do you know what I mean? I think that was essential. Music, you can't go wrong.
Give me that house. Music. You're listening to CNR Online. Advertise your business on this station for less than €7 a day. That's €7 to advertise your business here on CNR. For full details, check out the website, allthewcnr-online.com. CNR Online.